Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is January 13th, 2011, and I want to let people know we had 226 downloads of last week's radio show. We are so grateful to have had Greg Glazer, a special guest, on, and he will be back, I believe, once a month. So stay tuned. Thanks for joining us today, and I'll welcome our co-host, Alan. He's on the line.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you doing this morning?
Doing great, and looking forward to our special show today that we have once a week. Today's quote is, "If evils come not, then our fears are in vain. And if they do, fear but augments the pain." And that was Ben Franklin, who lived in 1706 to 1790, just about he died around the time when Hahnemann was starting his activity with homeopathy. And I was wondering how you interpret that quote, "If evils come not, then our fears are in vain. And if they do, but fear but augments the pain." Did you think about it at all?
Well, it sort of depends to me. The first part of that depends on if our fears have anything to do with why evil comes not. I mean, if we channel our fear in a constructive way, we may prevent or lessen a current or impending evil.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I think it's a statement about the perhaps the futility or even detriment of fear in and of itself. There are, some would assert, rational and irrational fears, and the rational ones are the ones that keep you from, say, walking out in front of a bus. And
mm-hmm.
The irrational ones, ones that really don't serve a constructive purpose and really kind of eat away at us. And so I think it is helpful for us to, first of all, recognize and become aware of our fears. Many of us have fears at many different levels and aren't even aware of them. And I can certainly vouch for that. I think it's understanding ourselves and our own subconscious or unconscious is a lifelong exploration for any who choose to embark upon it. It's not something you decide to do and then you've done it instantly. But many of us have hidden fears to explore and discover that, to the extent that they're undiscovered, can block our way forward.
Yeah, and why we act that way. I kind of put you on the spot with that question, and because I had read it and tried to give myself, what does that mean to me? And as we were speaking a bit in our last show, America seems to be in the mode of preemptive strike. In war and in peace, in sickness and in health, we live in a state of fear. I mean, this is really promoted across the airwaves. And that kind of motivates us to take certain, perhaps unnecessary actions, even before we have reached a state that requires them or have enough knowledge about facts that would require certain actions to be taken. So we may shoot first and unintentionally harm on the battlefield, or even for a child during their sensitive stage of mental and physical development when we give injections and vaccinations. So last week we did speak about these individual freedoms being under attack under martial law or circumstances where the federal government would have the legal authority to step in and take over. These are the reasons why, you know, we do take legal action and create legislation to protect ourselves when it's necessary. But what about when we create that state of fear unnecessarily? That's kind of how I'm interpreting what Benjamin Franklin wrote.
Well, I certainly took your question on a very personal level, and you're looking at it in a way much more pertinent to the show and the topics we've been discussing on more of a collective level or societal level. And one way, perhaps the most effective way to control people collectively is through fear. And we are tasked as a society, and more particularly those elected to make decisions on the behalf of local or regional or national communities, with sort of balancing and looking for a balance between the reasonable fear, the rational fear, and, you know, where to draw the lines. You know, oftentimes people say, you know, do I have a right to do this or that or the other? And often the answer to that is either it depends or up to a point. Lawyers can be very annoying when they give answers that aren't clear yes or no answers, but that's because often they understand that it's an issue that really doesn't lend itself to a yes or no answer. A lot of times it does depend. You know, where is the boundary of this right versus another? And, of course, with vaccines, our topic here, historically the boundary between our right to refuse and the state's right to impose vaccines on us has been based upon the prevailing views of where the needs of the community will outweigh the needs of the individual. I think probably most of us could get on board with that general concept. Where there is much disagreement with the topic of vaccines in particular is who gets to draw that line and on what basis and so forth. And there's a more insidious side to all of this, that where someone, where there is a position of power, a position of control, a position to make a decision that's going to have business and non-business implications to people, those in particular with a business or other compelling interest will inevitably seek, or some of those at least, will inevitably seek to influence the position of power or control to get an outcome in their favor. That, of course, is what the anti-vaccine community believes has occurred with the pharmaceutical industry. We talk about sometimes the revolving door between federal agencies and state agencies and the industry, where, for example, a little over a year ago, the director of the CDC announced that she was changing jobs from director of the CDC, a federal agency, to president of Merck Vaccines. It's just really hard to hear something like that and imagine that the people in the federal agencies are really recommending and making policy objectively all of the time based on what is truly in the best interest of the nation.
So it goes back to that quote from Benjamin Franklin. He was a really wise man. Today we are concerned about protecting our fundamental constitutional rights and, like what the purpose of this show is, to educate the public so that when the day comes, God forbid, that an emergency is declared, we can retain our dignity, a judicious system of government, individual liberties, and our right to sustainable living. That was discussed on last week's show. And we have some news coming up. Every time I think about the messages out there in the media regarding get your vaccination for the swine flu or get your vaccination for this seasonal flu, I don't see any flu out there. Why am I taking this preemptive strike when there are other ways, of course, that we know of, getting outside, getting some exercise, vitamin D, vitamin C, thinking positive. Sanitary measures are the number one prevention. There are other ways. So we do have some news coming up. I wanted for you to introduce that about what's going on in Canada and with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, if there was anything else you wanted to say before that, that would be great.
Well, just that there are any number of examples in pertaining to the pharmaceutical industry in general and vaccines in particular, where there is some evidence to suggest that the public has been and continues to be manipulated through fear to not only the financial benefit of the pharmaceutical industry, and there's nothing wrong with a business profiting and being successful in and of itself, but when that end is achieved through dishonest manipulation of facts and science, then of course there's a tremendous amount wrong with that. What makes this particular issue so more compelling and sensitive, if that's the right word for it, is that many of us feel that this occurs not just to the unfair or inappropriate financial gain in the pharmaceutical industry, but to the detriment of the health and lives of many people who suffer permanent injury or death from vaccines. Many of us believe unnecessarily, in part because of what you just mentioned, Debbie, that there are a lot of alternatives to vaccines. And to many people, vaccines are sort of a no-brainer. Why would you not get a vaccine and protect yourself from a disease? And if it were only that simple, you know, and it's just the very first couple of pieces to the answers to that are, well, first we need to know if the vaccines are effective and if they're safe, and are there alternatives that are safer or more effective and less costly and so forth. So just one quick example, the CDC began promoting the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act 3 months after 9/11. Regardless of what your position is on 9/11, inside job or not, the country certainly at that time was very much within a wake of fear from that event. And the timing of the pushing of the Model Act, which has been enacted in most states in one part or another, and which many of us believe, myself included, grants sweeping powers, excess power, to states to control the population during emergency times and situations. Most states, for example, can mandate vaccines without exemptions if they declare an emergency, and can quarantine people in a location of their choosing, which brings up for many people fear about all of these so-called FEMA camps. But the point is that many of us feel that we should have a right to say no thank you to vaccines. We'd rather address this through vitamin D or homeoprophylaxis or just quarantine in our homes. Thank you very much. So it's a deep and complex subject, and the one we only scratched the surface of last week with Greg about what are the rights of the constitutional limitations of the state's ability to impose vaccines in a condition of declared emergency or state of martial law. Not a short answer question, and I'm really looking forward to delving into that deeper with Greg in the weeks ahead.
Wonderful. So, yes, I am looking forward to that, too. And we have a lot to learn and educate the public so that they can take action by going on to the networks and learning how they can make steps to change legislation in favor of individual rights when there is an imbalance in the government, which seems to be what has, you know, during different eras and periods of time, the pendulum swings one way or the other. And we do want to have a balance of power in the center so that there are checks and balances, when right now we seem to have lost that. And that's why we need lawyers, even though they don't have a great name in the public eye. But we do need them, especially those that are looking out for our personal rights. And that's why I enjoy speaking and learning from you. Did you want to tell us what's going on in the news today? I think that there's a lot of current events that we had wanted to speak about.
Well, and Debbie, I keep thinking we're going to come up to a lull in the traffic, and I keep not seeing one. Even over the holidays, news just kept flooding on in. But most recently, one news topic in particular has been up, and it's very distressing to me. A British doctor, Andrew Wakefield, has been in the news in the past, and I thought we were past all of that, and yet it came up again. Apparently, one of the journalists who had originally gone out after Dr. Wakefield wrote an article that was published in the British Medical Journal, this time accusing him of outright fraud. For those maybe not familiar with Andrew Wakefield, he's a British doctor and surgeon, did some research about 12 years ago, a study in 1998 that suggested a link between autism and vaccines, and that link deserved further study. It's really important to underscore at the beginning here that he was not saying there was a link. He was not anti-vaccine. I don't know that he is even that today, but I think at one point he was suggesting that perhaps the MMR ought to be taken separately, but he did nothing to discourage people from vaccinating. He merely suggested that there's something here for further study. He has been raked over the coals, would be a delicate way of putting it, by the medical system to the point of losing his license, accused of many serious wrongdoings. I have seen a two-hour interview that Dr. Mercola did with Dr. Wakefield. I think that's probably available on Mercola.com still. I just recently listened to an interview between Dr. Wakefield and Gary Null, and that's probably available on Gary Null's website.
And we saw him in person.
And we did. Actually, I had the great honor of meeting him in Chicago last year, and sharing a stage with him at a rally there, and saw him speak there as well at a conference there. I'm convinced that this is a man of the utmost integrity who has been deliberately and very inappropriately made an example.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes, unfortunately, to sort of reinforcing some of the general fears. I'm sorry to say, you know, when I encounter people who, upon raising a question about vaccines, who respond in a complete denial and defiance of there could possibly, you know, how could there possibly be anything wrong with vaccines kind of mentality, I find myself wanting to say, I know exactly what you mean. That's where I was before I researched the subject. But it's true. That's where I was. There was a point in my teens, I remember hearing a radio report about some religious community not vaccinating, and I remember thinking, hey, if you want to believe in God, that's fine, but don't be an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you believed in science. You believed in science.
Well, you know, I had never heard of anything that would call vaccines into question in terms of whether they work or not, whether they have any harmful effects or not. And the first time I heard from a friend that another friend of hers had a child who was permanently damaged by a vaccine, I was shocked. I had never heard of that before. And now I know that this goes on, you know, routinely in numbers that we really can't and don't know, because as the FDA and CDC both have already told us publicly, that the number of adverse drug events that are reported are only something on the order of 1 to 10% of events actually occurring. So there's really no way that we can know at this point what the scope of the death and disability caused by vaccines is. And, I mean, we can speculate on it. There are some studies. There was one study in particular, independent study, looking at the correlation between the swine flu vaccine and miscarriages, and these independent researchers came to the conclusion that that were potentially as many as, I don't remember the exact number, it was around 3,500 miscarriages potentially in the U.S. Associated with the swine flu vaccine. Of course, you'll never hear that through mainstream media, but that goes back to the same initial fear mm-hmm. question and the same, shall we say, allegation, if you want to call it that, on my part, that fear is used to deliberately control, manipulate in inappropriate ways. Well, we have some real tangible evidence of the ability and willingness of pharmaceutical executives to behave in that manner, at least generally. A little over a year ago, in 2009, one pharmaceutical company had $1 billion, that's billion with a B, $1 billion criminal fine, in addition to a $1.3 billion civil fine. You don't get a criminal fine by simple negligence, forgetting something or overlooking something. You get a criminal fine by doing something unlawful and deliberately that has the, in the case of a pharmaceutical company, the potential, or perhaps actually occurred, causing people harm. Part of the rationale for the $1 billion criminal fine being so high was that this was the fourth time since the same company, since 2002, the same company had engaged in the same kind of criminal activity. Now, the only conclusion I can come to about a company that just repeatedly does the same thing over and over again and pays the criminal fine and goes on and does it again is because it makes financial sense. It certainly doesn't make moral sense. It doesn't make ethical sense. There's no measure that I can think of other than a purely cold calculating financial one that it would make any sense to do that. And the reason I think that most of us are not aware or not really able to hear and fully consider and contemplate what this really means in terms of the day-to-day impact and risk that it poses for all of us as citizens is that most of us are not capable of doing something like that. You know, if you or I did something on the order of what these companies are doing, we would be serving prison time for it. To the best of my knowledge, pharmaceutical executives do not go to prison for their criminal activities. They get hit with sometimes very large criminal fines. But in the context of an international pharmaceutical company, and I'm sure they felt that $1 billion fine, but does that mean that they learned their lesson and will never do it again? Well, that was the fourth time, you know, in a period of 7 years. So, you know, on average, about every other year, they're going to engage and get caught in some other serious criminal activity. We are currently compelled, required, mandated to take products from this industry. And that it was not an isolated company. There were, I think, four different companies that had fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars, combination of criminal and civil fines just in the last 2 or 3 years.
Can I interrupt and ask you a question here? I'm curious, in the legal sense, if these fines are not making one iota bit of difference in the behavior of these companies, are they, and they're basically not effective in changing what's going on in their criminal activity, what other options legally does the government have to arrest what's going on?
Well, I don't mean to be picky here, but I'm not sure it's having no effect, but it clearly is not having the effect, intended effect. And the events recur and they happen with multiple pharmaceutical companies. And so it does seem to be an industry-wide issue. I mean, I think if a pharmaceutical CEO served prison time, I think we would see either a dramatic reduction in this kind of behavior, or we would see very much more elaborate efforts to hide, suppress, and cover it up. And let me give you one example. There's been a really strong movement to take pharmaceutical research overseas, in particular to third world countries. The FDA can't regulate that. And mm-hmm. so, if you can't get away with what you're doing here, you either correct the behavior or you go somewhere else where you can't be held accountable for it. Again, this kind of behavior is not something that most of us can even wrap our minds around, and so we somehow either are unaware of it or can't, you know, I think it persists because we can't, as a society, imagine that anybody would behave this way. And so we're somehow mm-hmm. not able to fully see it or recognize it or do anything about it. I mean, it's not that nobody's doing anything about it. Obviously, if someone got hit with a $1 billion criminal fine, there's somebody mm-hmm. trying to do something about it. But if it's going to happen over and over again, something more does need to happen, and you're absolutely right. And I think serving jail time would be a great deterrent. But I'm not convinced
even
that
would
necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, there. I'm not sure. You know, maybe short of a profound evolutionary jump in human beings to a place where no one would be able to do that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. You know.
Okay, so that was also a point of discussion on the last show about how human beings themselves can evolve to be better people in the future, kind of a utopian world Greg was talking about. But so what I hear based on what you've said so far is those people who are in power and are not taking responsibility or accountability for their actions or for the harm that they incur on the general population just for the sake of money, for the sake of the holy dollar bill or whatever, that it's going to be up to us as individuals to be educated, to ask the media, well, here we are blogging and talking, we have technology today in the internet, to get out there and inform others about this criminal activity and ask why they're not being accountable, and in that way let people know the effects of the vaccinations and what are the toxins that are in there and how they can affect you, and talk to people who have been affected just on the grassroots effort of people. And that seems to be where it's at, because that upper echelon is not going to do anything. And like you say, they can escape, they can go overseas, they can hide what they're doing or get out of, as Dr. Bob on the comments says, they're not going to go to prison. Goldman Sachs committed fraud to the extent of $50 billion to its clients, and they paid fines, and no one will serve time. So he also has a couple more comments, but go ahead.
Well, we live in a country that has a structure that allows us to make some changes. I'm not sure that the system works near as well as intended, or perhaps as it did when we were a much smaller country. But the potential is still there. Grassroots efforts, I do think, can change things. And if a majority of people, so there is a two-part process here with these problems in general, and that is first the awareness and education. And that goes to another thought I had right after I was telling you, gee, I'm not sure what we can do, but transparency really is key, and education is informing people about what's going on, getting all the ideas on the table, and not allowing somebody else to decide which ideas get on the table and which ones don't. Because there's another quote from Ben Franklin, and I wish I could give it to you verbatim, but basically what he says is, when you clear the way for truth to get on the table, people will be able to see what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
That it will stand on its own merits ultimately, I think, was the gist of it. And what we have is a society in which certain people control information in a way that they get to sort of decide what is the at least most widely believed truth, whether it's in fact objectively true or not. And that's what has to be done away with. There has to be transparency in our government, in our state and federal agencies. There has to be fair play. There has to be a clear table for all ideas to be, any reasonable idea, any idea asserted by a reasonable and sane person that has some basis to it, and not just something that somebody in power decides, whether with good intentions or not, that idea doesn't get on the table, sort of arbitrarily. So, you know, we should have the right as citizens, for example, to choose if this were a valid, and this probably for some people is considered a valid choice anyway, between, say, vaccines and homeoprophylaxis or whatever, other alternatives you want to put on the table there. But there are demonstrated successful and safe alternatives. Why, under any rational system, should we not have the choice to choose one that appears to us and for us to be safer or more effective or less expensive. I'm not of the position that vaccines should not be an option, at least over the short term. I have a personal position on that, but my professional position is that this is an issue about choice, freedom of choice, personal autonomy, and it's not a decision our government should be making for us. The rationale for the government to make it for us is that everybody has to be participating in this or it doesn't work, and it's just not a logical theory. It's saying that because of the herd immunity theory, you have to get most people vaccinated, or in an emergency, everyone vaccinated, or somehow it's not going to work. Somehow, if I'm not vaccinated, your vaccine isn't going to work. And the rationale, just it just doesn't really quite hold up. But it's a policy that has a very powerful fear base to it. And people are much more driven by the fear than they are someone else's attempt to try and explain and explore it rationally and to really look at the alternatives. And so that's very powerful stuff.
Well, Ben Franklin was a very wise man, and I was not able to find your specific quote that you were talking about, that if you clear the way for truth, then people will be able to see. But he also said, half a truth is often a great lie, which means that we're only getting half the message. If the media and the government, as proponents of vaccinations due to the herd immunity theory, give us that information without giving us all of the options, like you said, they're giving us a lie. And then they're also saying to us, in effect, you do not have the wisdom to make a decision on your own. You are not either educated or smart enough or intelligent enough or have enough brains to make your own decision about how you're going to care for your health and your children's health.
That's only part of it, though, to be perfectly honest, because while I do think that's part of it, I think with vaccines, part of the rationale is that you can't make an individual choice, because if you made something that you felt was in your interest and you felt it was that not being vaccinated was in your interest, you are putting other people at risk for doing that.
Okay.
And so, therefore, somebody has to stand out above the crowd and tell the whole crowd what to do, because individuals can ruin it for everybody else. That's the rationale. Now, you know, we can certainly debate the scientific merits or lack of merits of that rationale, but and it's an interesting one because well, first of all, it's been effective and successful in getting vaccines mandated and keeping them mandated for quite some time in this country, and has been the a propelling force for more and more vaccines to be added to the mandatory list, despite the absence of outbreaks of all these diseases that would be a justification for taking some kind of action, whether you think vaccination, widespread vaccination, is the answer or not. So, but it's a very convenient way for people to step into a position of power and control and to control the masses to one degree. So whether it's there for the sake of control or, you know, for something more or other than what it purports to be on the surface, is a legitimate question when what it purports to do on the surface doesn't make sense. Then, you know, when the policy doesn't make sense, then it's really critical to ask, well, who gains by this policy? You know, if the policy makes sense, we probably don't care who gains because we want what's best for everybody. If it doesn't make sense, well, why else would it be there? Why would they be perpetrating a half-truth you know, whether deliberately or not, why would they be doing that unless there was some gain or benefit somewhere? Well, you know, the obvious one is that vaccines are a multi-billion-dollar international industry. Every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth until, as I like to say tongue-in-cheek, the last vaccine takes us out. So that's just an enormous market. There's over 330 vaccines currently either in development or on the market already. It's just a pharmaceutical feeding frenzy, as I like to call it. You know, who in the medical field, at least on first brush, wouldn't initially want to get a piece of that action?
We have a little bit of time left, and I think that we should let people know what was recently in the news just today about the Canada decision by a judge. And if or how the American or other nations will even look at this as I know it's not United States precedent, but what it will introduce into the discussion for us here in America.
Boy, I want to address just a couple of different parts and pieces to that. Again, not to be picky, but I think it's an important thing to understand that we have in our legal system both state and federal court systems, and we have what are often referred to as the trial courts or lower court. That's the what you see on TV all the time on court shows. And then we have courts of appeal or appellate courts, and often in state and federal systems, there'll be two different levels of appellate courts. You go to one appeals court and don't like that, you can take it to a higher appeals court. Most legal precedent in the formal sense of that word in state courts comes out of the appellate courts. In other words, what happens at trial isn't necessarily going to determine in any way what happens in a similar situation in another trial. But what ruling comes out of an appellate court can be, it certainly isn't always, it depends on the court and the court's decision, but can be formal legal precedent that then guides the trial courts or even appellate courts in the future, in future cases. But in the sort of informal sense of the word precedent, then certainly any ruling coming out of even a trial court could be a concern. Now, there was a case, I don't know if we're talking about the same case or not, there was a case last month in Canada where a judge refused to order vaccines for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that got lots of cheers here in the States, as well it should. And I was very happy to see that too. But I wanted to caution people about that, not to interpret that as meaning that something like that would be as likely or possible here in the U.S. First of all, my understanding is that in Canada, there's not the kind of vaccine requirements that we have here. In fact, vaccines aren't required in England. I don't think they're required in Australia. There's a lot of developed countries that don't mandate vaccines the way we do here in the U.S. I like to say somewhat jokingly, I guess, but with a very sincere streak of seriousness to it, that, you know, we're a huge market here. So the first place, if my goal were to make money on vaccines, the first place I would want to see mandates would be in the U.S. because that's your, you know, a huge market. But anyway.
Do you want me to read that news article? It was posted in the Calgary Sun from Alberta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it said, the judge refuses to order vaccinations, by Kevin Morton. Vaccinations aren't essential, quote-unquote, medical treatments. A family court judge has ruled in refusing a child welfare request to order inoculations for four kids. Judge Stephen Lipton, in a written decision released Thursday, this was an article today, said while the vaccinations are preferable, it wasn't in his power to order them. Child welfare had applied for a ruling to have the siblings immunized despite their parents' decision not to allow the treatment. But Lipton said the four children, ranging in age from 1 to 12, weren't at any present risk, so no court intervention was warranted. Quote, you want me to finish this?
No, that's fine. No, that's the same article from last month.
Okay.
The difference between that and here in the U.S. is here vaccines are considered essential.
Okay.
And you have to, in fact, you have to proactively seek out and exercise a proper exemption to avoid them.
Okay.
At least to legally avoid them. And so I think it's very unlikely that you'd have that same kind of ruling here. Now, let me clarify, though, because while this was not a case of two parents disagreeing over whether or not to vaccinate, it was the state, welfare department, I think,
yes,
trying to get the kids vaccinated, and the parents were saying, well, no, we don't want to vaccinate. And I think the judge did, well, it's easy to imagine a judge ordering vaccines under the current mainstream beliefs about vaccines. I think the judge probably did, I don't know Canadian law, but I would have to venture a guess that the judge did the legally correct thing. Since vaccines are not mandated, then a judge really shouldn't and maybe even couldn't mandate vaccines, order vaccines for kids in Canada unless there were some medical reason to justify why these children should be treated differently from other children with regard to whether or not the state, you know, does mandate vaccines. Here in the U.S. where they're mandated, I think you'd more likely have the opposite outcome. But let me elaborate a bit on that, because I've had an increase in cases in very recent years in my own practice, what I refer to as vaccine custody disputes. The typical case, they're all different, but the typical one is where parents agree not to vaccinate a child. It may be that they're both actively involved, or it may be that one goes along with the other one. But in any case, they don't vaccinate the kids. Then they separate or divorce, and one parent says, aha, I can make the other parent look like a fruitcake for mm-hmm. for his or her non-vaccine views, and I can get custody. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they really were pro-vaccine all along, and they just sort of went along with it for the sake of the marriage or whatever. But in any case, the expectation we should have, because this is usually the starting place, is that attorneys and judges will look at a case like that or a dispute like that and see it as a no-brainer. Of course you vaccinate the kids. That's in their best interest. Why are you even raising the question? It turns out, though, that especially, perhaps not exclusively, but especially where there's a history of religious objection, there are some very powerful constitutional law arguments in favor of the non-vaccinating parent. And I'm happy to say I've had success with working with family law attorneys in several different states now, or several cases in at least a few different states on these kind of cases. Judges... Oh, go ahead. You have a question?
Yeah, Alan. We are coming up. We have like 2 minutes left. And I do want to let people know that this is your field of expertise, that you have written an ebook all about the legal ins and outs of vaccinations, waivers, and rights that an individual has, and that there are so many situations a person needs to make an informed decision about these exemptions and waivers. And your book guides that person to educate themselves, learn about it as much as possible, and if need be, get in touch with you personally to find out if you can assist them in advocacy, in doing what they feel is right for themselves and their family. Do you want to add to that?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, Debbie. Just that while I have truly and humbly the greatest respect for all of my peers in the alternative vaccine community, that to my distress, many otherwise highly reputable websites have a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information about exemption procedures and rights. And that's why I wrote the ebook, because I saw a lot of misunderstanding. Even from the highly reputable sites, alternative medical doctors and vaccine authors, I see some of this. And so I just urge people to be cautious when they're searching the internet for information. But no one provided information in depth like the ebook does, or even some of the information for free on my website. So I encourage folks to go there as at least part of their exploration into their rights on this issue.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the comments and questions from the chat today, and we're going to start the next show with that so that people can get answers to their questions and know that we are listening to their comments. And in the meantime, I want to thank everyone who has tuned in to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States. And we will have Alan back each week, and a special guest, Greg, will be coming back once a month. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
We dream about a world at work where people really care. Let your truth be a girl.